Thank you, Yvonne. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Steve Lee. I'm an alcoholic. And Yvonne's the first person that's ever said that I've heard out loud that she was going to take directions from me. So I couldn't be happier. We'll see how that goes, Yvonne. and I couldn't be more excited to be here with you guys and to share this next the workshop in the next 2 or 3 hours with my friend June, who I recruited to join me on this. When Yvonne reached out to me, you know, I had done I'd been part of a little workshop on emotional sobriety that was 20 minutes of a lead. And Yvonne reached out to me later and invited me to this and said it was 4 hours. And I said, Yvonne, I had to start making stuff up just to get 20 minutes. So you've heard the best I've got, but June and I will do our best to provide some content since the time and space has been created for us. But I reached out to June because I knew that, number one, she and I are just dear friends, and I have such tremendous respect for her as a stalwart member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we've been looking for a chance to do something together for about a year or two now, and this presented that opportunity, so I'm grateful for you guys allowing us to do it. And that emotional sobriety is the topic that we're going to explore a little bit today. As Yvonne said, one of the things we want to invite is because I think I said at a meeting the other night, I can see that there are 130 participants with us right now. There'll be about 8 of us for the last hour. I know when I see those numbers, you know, when you leave, just realize that I'm watching that number drop, and my insecurity is heightened dramatically as one by one you leave the virtual room. So be gentle with us. But because we know that for a variety of reasons, not everybody will be able to be here from beginning to end, that we do want to invite those questions via chat as we go along. And when we take a break and come back, we will address, if there are questions, maybe 2 or 3 of those, and then move on. And hopefully during the course of the afternoon, get to your questions. And then, of course, we also want to create some space for you guys to share back with us a little bit too. So we'll kind of figure some of this out as we go along, but we're real excited to be here with you. We thought it made sense, obviously, to spend a little bit of time here at the front end, 10 or 15 minutes each, kind of qualifying as alcoholics and for the 12-step program that we're a part of. I know that there, at least during Stephanie's talk, who, by the way, is a dear friend of mine and did a wonderful job, that the percentage of Al-Anons to alcoholics on today's meeting is about reverse of what I'm used to, because typically I'm at an AA event with the Al-Anon participation. So frankly, it's cool for me to be able to walk across the hall, as it were, virtually speaking and share with you guys. And I think this topic, and Yvonne spoke to it earlier, really lends itself to that, you know, because I think that as I will share in a minute, as I'm sure June will make clear when we qualify as alcoholics, the single characteristic that all alcoholics have in common is the phenomenon of craving, the allergy to alcohol that Dr. Silkworth talks about in The Doctor's Opinion. But it's been my personal experience and my point of view, I won't argue with anybody who might have a different one, that the unmanageability part of the first step, where I think the emotional sobriety is contained, the unmanageability part of the first step is used in over 200 other 12-step programs. So while that second half of the first step, the unmanageability, is common to the alcoholic, it's not exclusive to the alcoholic. So I think I think that we all can meet under the same banner of emotional sobriety. So we're grateful for that. I'm going to invite June into the conversation now and let her introduce herself and what she hopes to accomplish today, which is get in a word edgewise with me. And then let her, June, I'll let you go on into to your qualifying, and then we'll take it from there. So thanks, guys, and please welcome June G.
Thanks, Steve. Hi, everybody. My name is June, and I'm an alcoholic. And not sure. I know there's people from all over the country here. So just in case it's the tradition where you're from, my sobriety date is July the 13th, 1972. That means I've been continually sober since I got here at 13 years old. I've been sober now 48 years. One of the most fascinating things about this whole journey for me is that I got to Alcoholics Anonymous feeling about 2000. And 48 years later, I feel a lot younger than I did when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank you for allowing me to be part of this. I want to thank Steve for asking me. You know, I know there's no question that Steve and I can together talk for 4 hours. We could just do it just on our own because we enjoy telling stories and spending time together. But I thought, you know, I don't honestly know of anything that either one of us or both of us together could say that could make this all that interesting, truthfully, for 4 hours. I already told Steve this, so I'm not hurting his feelings. But what I thought about was that, you know, there have been many times in my sobriety, more often in my early years, where I just needed to be in a meeting. And I needed that for whatever reason. And so I figure if nothing else, Steve and I are going to hang out in this Zoom room for 4 hours. We'll tell a few stories. We'll share some of our experience, strength, and hope. And what they used to say a lot when I got sober was take what you can use and leave the rest, you know. And most important thing that I'll say while I share right now, just so you know, I'll say it right up front so you don't have to necessarily pay attention. I'm setting my timer right now. Most important thing I'll say is that I'm not an expert. I'm not an expert on alcoholism. I'm not an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not an expert on any step, and I'm certainly not an expert on emotional sobriety. So I'm just going to be sharing, you know, my experience, strength, and hope, and probably sharing some things that I've seen or learned or that have been shared with me by other members of the program, both of AA and Al-Anon, because I've been very fortunate that Al-Anon has added tremendously, Al-Anon members have added tremendously to my life. And, you know, even I was thinking about it too, even before I got asked to be a part of this, that so often a lot of us, you know, don't know or we forget how much Al-Anon has contributed. You know, one of the great guides in my life was a guy named Sandy Beach, which some of you may or may not have ever heard of. But, you know, Sandy went to his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they took him to one of those meetings where it was going to be like a 10-hour event. I'm exaggerating because I'm Irish. I'm going to do that a little bit. But they took him out there, and he got out way out in the country, and he was out there, and they were going to have, you know, like a 2-hour dinner and then a 2-hour meeting and then a 3-hour dance. And before, you know, during the dinner part, at the very beginning of the evening, you know, Sandy went outside and he was standing on the porch. It was his first day sober. And he was saying, I can't do this. You know, I mean, he'd just gotten out of a straitjacket, out of a mental institution. He's like, I can't do this. And an Al-Anon woman came up to him and said, you know, it's going to be all right. And he came back in and he stayed for the dinner and he stayed for the meeting. And he went on to stay sober almost 50 years before he passed away and helped an awful lot of people, including me. So there are lots of little ways that sometimes we don't even know how many people have contributed to our life, be they in AA or Al-Anon, or lots of other things, of course, too. You don't have to just be a member of either program to add into the world. I guess I'll tell you a little bit about what I was like. I think that, you know, that could be relevant, certainly to emotional sobriety. My first obsession wasn't even with alcohol. My first obsession in life was with suicide. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I grew up with a lot of violence. I grew up with a lot of other kinds of abuse that happened in some homes. And I grew up with a lot of broken promises. And by the time I was 5 years old, I already knew that life just hurt way too much. And I didn't want to be here. You know, I didn't want to interact with people. And I knew that everything was just going to hurt. And I knew that there wasn't anything good coming. And I wanted out. And I began to try on a regular basis with suicide attempts to try and get out, because I just couldn't handle the pain. Luckily for me, the way I see it now, I see it luckily, alcohol worked for me the way that it talks about in the doctor's opinion. I get a special reaction to alcohol that not everyone gets. And it allowed me to take a deep breath, and it allowed the pain to stop. And I wasn't a party girl. I never had a social drink in my life. I drank completely for the effect. And I'm very, very grateful that the effect was there and that it worked for me the way that it did. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was not because I necessarily wanted what they had. I did not understand what was available in Alcoholics Anonymous. And even in those early meetings, as I sat there listening to people share, I did not believe that I could have the kind of life that they were talking about. But I did know that I didn't want what I had anymore. And so I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have continued to stay active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in different ways, you know, because we have so many different ways to be of service in the program and to practice these principles. But I did come into Alcoholics Anonymous and get active, but I had a rotten attitude. And I had a rotten attitude for a long time. It took a long time for me to feel grateful. I felt sorry for myself much more than I felt grateful in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought I was kind of being cursed. That's why I was having to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and stay sober and never have fun ever again. And I was going to be bored out of my mind. And there was never nothing ahead. And that's really pretty much how I felt. I'd like to let you know that, you know, if they could have told me, or if they had told me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that if I'd go back out and drink the way that I was drinking and continue to live with the amount of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization I was living with, if they could have told me that if I did that for another 6 months that I could die, I would have been out the door. I did not stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was afraid of dying. I really had wanted to die. I stayed sober in Alcoholics Anonymous because I believed that I would be able to continue to live the way that I was living year in and year out for another 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years, like some members of Alcoholics Anonymous had. And by the time I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not have hated myself any more than I did when I got here. Feeling that way about myself when I got sober, I didn't just take a 30-day chip and begin to have good feelings about myself or like myself or begin to be my friend. It's been a very, 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 in my case, slow process of this transformation that I have had and that I believe any alcoholic who's going to have long-term sobriety will need to have. And I have been very, very fortunate in Alcoholics Anonymous, because there have always been wonderful guides to walk with me and ahead of me and to come behind me. And I believe that that's a big part of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, is that we are these different generations, not just in the sense of age, but in the sense sometimes of sobriety and experience. I love in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe our greatest strength is that we're people who normally would not mix. And I think that that adds so much to my life and to the lives, you know, of other people that I've gotten to know over the years. You know, as far as the topic of emotional sobriety, you know, I have a friend who I think she still has signed on to the meeting. And Kay had just celebrated 45 years of sobriety, you know, last month in August. And when Kay went to kindergarten, her parents were called on the first day of kindergarten. And the principal called them up, and they came in, and they told her parents, they said, Kay is not emotionally ready for kindergarten. And Kay can give a great talk about how even on a day-to-day basis, there are days where we wake up and we feel like I am not emotionally ready, you know, for this job, for these health issues, for these issues with my kids, for relationship issues, for pandemic issues, for financial issues, I mean, whatever it is. And so I don't know that there's a, at least for me so far, there isn't like one day where I walked through and I suddenly had emotional sobriety and I have hung on to it continually ever since. It is more of a process. I do know that I have a lot more emotional sobriety in my later years of sobriety than I did in my early years. I'm very, very grateful that I was taught to not drink no matter what and to keep coming back, and that I did that, and that I continued to try and to change and to evolve, because I think that's kind of, you know, a lot of what it's about. I was at a meeting this past week, and a wonderful a friend of mine who just, he celebrated 40 years recently, Israel, was sharing, and he said, you know, it's not so much, he had 40 years, I think I just said that, but he said, you know, it's not so much that what I was doing at 10 years or 12 years or 5 years or 20 years was wrong. It was more doing the right thing, but then finding other ways to evolve and to do the right thing and to build upon that. And that's been a lot more of what, you know, my sobriety has been. It has been a learning process, which, of course, the number one thing I would say, if I had to give one word, it has to do with humility, you know, with becoming teachable. And sadly, that is still very hard for me. I don't like to ask for help. I don't like to admit that I don't know. But I have learned in sobriety, usually from pain and embarrassment, that I need to do that. And I also need my friends to remind me, you know, of that, to remind me to call my sponsor, or to remind me to reach out, or to remind me to laugh. Because when I'm able to laugh at myself, things are a lot better. I'm going to tell you this really silly story that I don't know if I've ever told it in a meeting, and has nothing really to do. That's just kind of the way my brain works. I'm just going to probably tell you throughout the afternoon a lot of silly stories. But strangely enough, a lot of them help me at different times, so maybe they could help you. So about 15 years ago, I was going through a divorce after 25 years. And it was a very hard time, even though I knew in a way that I've rarely known anything in my life, that it was absolutely the right thing. It was the best thing for me. It was the best thing for him. It was the best thing for our three kids. It was just the best thing. And yet it surprised me, still does somehow when I look back, how hard it was to walk through something even when I knew it was right. But anyway, so in going through that, when I was going through that divorce, I was, you know, I had some low days, you know what I mean, where I was really kind of beating myself up or not feeling very good about myself or whatever. And I have this one friend in the program, and she just loves makeup, and she loves to dress up, and she loves to do all of that stuff. And I, you know, I like doing that sometimes, but not the way that she does, you know. And my little voice in my head the night before said, you know what, you got to listen to what Linda says. And she'll say, feeling, you know, crappy, dress up pretty. And so I got up the next morning and I thought, you know what, I was going to work. I thought, I am going to pretend like this is the most important day of my life. I'm going to wear everything. I mean, it was work, so it wasn't going to be like an Academy Award gown. But I thought, you know, I am going to just dress and go out there looking the best I have ever looked. And so I put on my best suit, and I had my great earrings on, and I had makeup on, and you know, and I went to work, and I was training a new lawyer at work. And so we were standing there, and there was this Spanish interpreter in the courtroom that we were working in. And he's very, very grumpy. I mean, he is just a curmudgeon of the worst kind. So I rarely try and talk to him unless I absolutely have to. And I was standing training this new lawyer, talking about different procedures, you know, that we needed to do. And this grumpy Spanish interpreter was there, and he suddenly interrupted while I was talking to this other guy. And he said to me, he said, when the light hits your hair at just that angle. And I thought, oh my gosh, I mean, this must be why, you know, what people say to women who dress up really, really nice. I mean, it sounded like this is something Cary Grant or something would say. When the light hits your hair at just that angle, he said, you look like a cone head. And I have this little ponytail here. I don't know if you can see it, but anyway. And I started to laugh so hard that then all the makeup that I had spent time, I mean, it just was running down my face. Meanwhile, the lawyer that was standing there, he looked like he'd been punched in the stomach. I mean, he could hardly take a breath. He was so worried about me. And I was laughing so hard. And I went in and, you know, had to go in the restroom and wipe off all this makeup and come back out. And I thought, now, I am telling you now, I am not sure I could have stayed sober through that in my first year, you know. But here, years later, I was able to just laugh, you know what I mean, to laugh at all different levels of that. And boy, what a wonderful thing to be able to laugh at some of the things that happen in the world and in my life. Because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have a sense of humor at all. I never thought anything that had to do with me or my life was funny. It was all about pain. And what a great gift I've been given here. And it's a huge part of my emotional sobriety when I'm able to have a sense of humor and to laugh at myself. And it is the people in the program who have helped me get that gift and keep it. So I'll turn it back over to Steve.
Thank you, June. You know, AA and Al-Anon are one of the few places where when you invite someone to come speak on the topic, they spend the first 5 minutes telling you they're not an expert on it. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I started reading the big book. And I think that thing is put together in a very unique, wonderful way, because there's it's through page 164 where our program is. And it's all the way on page 164 that we say we realize we know only a little. You know, if that was on the first page, I might not have committed to the read, you know, but they gave me some time to get trapped in there. So June and I realized we know only a little, but that does not keep us from pontificating at great length about the little that we know. And so again, I'm glad to be here. My sobriety date is June 30th, 1989. And I was 35 years old, and my background, my family life could not be more different than June's. But here we are. And that's the magic of where we are today. We have this common problem and a common solution. And the other exterior aspects of our lives are critically important, but they don't separate us. And what I find when we talk about this emotional sobriety, when we begin to dig in, if you will, about how I feel and sometimes why I do what I do, and perhaps just as critically important, why I don't do or haven't done some of the things I haven't done, we find a great commonality. What I have found is when I share the truth about me with you, those very things that I was being protective of, you know, my pride and my ego are my enemies. You know, that they come dressed as my friends and, like the government, say we're here to help. But what they really do is tell me that I can't let you know this about me, and require me to act a certain way, and all because I'm trying to present. In a particular way, a facade that somehow is going to get me what I think I need from you, the dependency that I have on people, places, and things. When I got sober on June 30th of 89, I wasn't intending to. I got run into Alcoholics Anonymous. I had multiple DUIs, and I'd been given some jail time, and they were going to cut some of that jail time off if I would go to residential drug and alcohol rehabilitation. And I promise you, until that district attorney strung all those words together, I'd never heard them all at one time. And I did not know what that was going to be, but it sounded marginally better than jail. And I did a little bit of both. And I got so fortunate in that, I got alcoholism as I began to hear the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous talk about their alcoholism. I was blessed with that identification that is so critical. And some of it was around the way that I drank, but a lot of it was around the way that I felt. And again, I think that on this screen, regardless of the 12-step program that someone might most closely identify with here today, I think we're going to find some real commonality, because most of those feelings are human feelings that are exacerbated sometimes by my alcoholism, that are out of proportion perhaps than folks who aren't as hypersensitive as I am. You know, an Alcoholics Anonymous says we alcoholics are sensitive people. I was sober several years before I realized that's not a compliment. And it should be a tip off, because right after it refers to it as a crippling handicap. But it took me a while to pick up on that, because that sensitivity isn't that I am compassionate and caring and sensitive in that way. The sensitivity that I showed up with at Alcoholics Anonymous is a hypersensitivity to being hurt, to being frightened, to being knocked off balance, to being made uneasy, to consistently and unendingly giving thought to what I think you think. And all of this stuff, you know, but like June said, this is 31 years later. And I had a conversation with a friend of mine yesterday. He's 74 years old and he's 39 years sober. And he said, Steve, I discovered something today. He said, what I really want is peace of mind. And I said, well, that didn't take long. You know, we're slow learners here, but man, that's what I want too. I want peace of mind. And the illusion that I suffer from is what's going to bring me that peace of mind. I get confused and think that peace of mind is somehow going to be the result of me getting out externally what I think I want. It's going to be, you know, June just said, she said that she's going to tell some stories, and I just thought of one that I had not planned to tell, but I'm going to tell it. And that'll happen a few times today. Be prepared to follow us down the rabbit hole, and we hope we will come back. But a number of years ago, I was catching a flight from Las Vegas to Nashville on Southwest. Now, this was about 15 or 18 years ago at least. And those of you who flew Southwest back then know that even their boarding protocols were even a little different than they are now. They had an A, B, and a C loading area, if you will, that you would get in, and they would load you and board you by that group. And I had a very specific seat that I prefer to sit in on Southwest, or on any plane, but I was flying primarily Southwest. And it is the aisle bulkhead. So I'm going to do what a guy needs to do to get the seat he wants to get on this Southwest flight. I get up early, because those flights from Vegas back east, they are always packed. So I get up early. And those of you who are familiar with that routine will recognize me. I'm the guy you didn't much like on Southwest flights. But I get to the gate 2 hours before flight time, because that's when they would then start giving you the boarding card an hour before the flight. I'm there 2 hours and sitting in front of the check-in desk. They come, finally, the crew comes on, or not the flight crew, but the airline personnel, and now they begin checking us in. I get in the first section, and then I go sit in that section. I don't go sit in the seat. I go sit on the floor, so I'm the very first person in that group, and I'm that guy that's sitting there reading, and, you know, I got 3 hours invested in this thing before there even other people are showing up. Now they start to board us, but you guys know, as they get ready to board, they ask for the pre-boarders. And now I'm eyeballing these pre-boarders. I'm telling you, I'm looking at them because I'm wondering how many adults get to board with that 1 3-year-old. This is bull. And I said, and I don't believe that woman needs that walker. I can see she's faking. And I'm picking this thing apart. I am worried about getting this seat that I want. And finally, they start boarding the important people. And I get on, and there it is, the crown jewel, the aisle seat, bulkhead. I get it. Now my job is to look like a person you wouldn't want to sit next to on that flight. Now my job is to spread that newspaper out, right, and kind of lean over into that center seat. And I'm watching, they're boarding now, and they're going back. And one of the things about being up front is even people in the last group, when they're coming on, they're optimists, you know. They still think somewhere back in the back that there is an aisle seat or a window seat, and they're not going to be stuck with that center seat. But they're all coming, and finally, they're getting ready to close the door, and it is work. There are only two vacant seats on this plane, the center seat next to me and the center seat directly across the aisle from me in the other bulkhead. And then this young couple comes on. And, man, I'm saying, somebody's going to ask me to move. Somebody's going to say, let them sit together. I'm looking at that newspaper. I'm not making eye contact with anybody. And I'm grumbling to myself. I said, I'm not moving. I did what I'm supposed to do. I've been here early. I'm defending my turf. And the guy sitting in the window seat on my aisle, just without a hesitation, without it didn't seem like even any remorse at all, called out to him. And he said, would you kids like to sit together? And the young man said, no, sir, that's okay. You'd have to sit. And he said, it'd be my pleasure. And he got up and he moved over across the aisle and he sat in that center seat. And those two kids came and sat down. And for 3.5 hours, I knew that I wanted to be the guy in that center seat. I got exactly what I thought I wanted. And it made me unhappy. I got exactly what I spent all morning worrying about the night before, every aspect of this, getting what I thought I wanted, and realizing that I wanted to be the man in that center seat who was unattached to what seat he was on in that airplane, who was unattached to this small target for happiness that a guy like me unknowingly and unconsciously paints on my own back. I create a scenario where there's such a small number of things that I think are going to make me happy or help me be okay, and then begin the pursuit of those things, the relentless, tireless, frightened pursuit of those things that I hope are going to bring me some peace of mind. Never realizing that the guy in the center seat, his freedom, you know, in the story Freedom from Bondage, she says that perhaps the only real freedom a human being ever knows is when he does what he ought to do because he wants to do it. Now, you guys have shared with me correctly that I need to do what I ought to do, whether I want to do it or not. But the freedom is when there is no conflict. That man that moved over to that center seat was not conflicted. He wasn't having to wrestle with himself about what the right thing to do was. It was not a challenge for him. He was free to sit by the window or sit in the center seat. And I don't recognize so often that what a victim I am to the small target I create for my own happiness and my own well-being. I think that's part of the talk that I want to continue today and where this will take us. You know, when Bill wrote the letter on emotional sobriety that's in the grapevine, and it was a response to a letter he had received, I think, from one or two other members about their depression. And we talk about Bill's depression and whether it was clinical or alcoholic depression, I don't know. I know in the fourth step, in the 12 and 12, he uses the phrase, those of us of depressive temperament. So I will tell you that I'm a guy who had a depressive temperament from time to time because I'm so easily disappointed. But Bill wrote this in 1953, or at least that's when it was reprinted in The Grapevine. And or 1958, I'm sorry. And I take great solace in the fact that he was 23 years sober when he wrote that. I take great solace in the fact that Bill was maybe not moving on any faster a track than I have in AA. And that he says in the very first paragraph of that letter that many AA oldsters had put our booze cure to severe but successful test. And what he's saying, there's a bunch of us are staying sober in AA. But what about the next frontier? And again, the fact that he's 23 years sober and now deciding to go exploring. You know, we're just now starting to move it over a little bit from this physical sobriety and the huge gift that is for a guy like me, but moving that over to emotional sobriety. You know, I looked up the word sobriety, and it says it's and this is around, I think, the physical sobriety. And it says it's the condition of not having any measurable levels or effects from alcohol or other drugs. So I've been sober. My last drink was June the 29th of 1989. I'm guessing I had no measurable levels or effects from that alcohol and the drugs I was taking at least a couple of days after that. I'm probably pretty cleaned out. I was probably as sober as I was ever going to get. But there was a second definition for sobriety. The other definition for sobriety, as I looked it up, it says sobriety is also considered to be the natural state of a human being given at birth. I kind of like that. I am really trying to get back to my natural state of a human being, unencumbered by these faulty dependencies, unencumbered by my assets, which have become liabilities and turned into the seven deadly sins, right, of sloth and envy and pride and lust and greed and those things that rob me of being who I really am and don't allow me to move freely in the world and experience my relationship with you and experience my relationship with God at the level that's available to me if I can become less encumbered, if the bonds of self are loosened just a bit, I am much closer to the natural state upon the day that I was given birth. No false fears, no false dependencies. And the 12 steps, as I have practiced them and go through this process, begin to loosen that bondage of self. And I become more stabilized, more sober, more emotionally sober. So we will explore that as we go. I'm going to give the rest of the hour to June and remind you guys, because we'll take a break here somewhere between 3:50 and, or I'm on Central Time, so don't get confused when I give you times here, but at 3:50 my time, because I'm not smart enough to look at my clock and then take two away. I'm a public school math, and I just cannot do that without having to you see me count out loud. And so at 3:50, between 3:50 and 4 o'clock Central Time, we'll take a 10-minute break. But June, fill the rest of the time for me.
All right, thanks. You know, there were lots of things, of course, that Steve, you know, said that brought thoughts into my mind. I wanted to tell you that, you know, when I got sober, one of our old timers was a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. And one of the things that Chuck would always talk about was that he would get up in the morning and he would ask God or his higher power, you know, whatever. He would say, you know, God, I'm going to move it around and you show me and help me know what I need to do to help God's kids do what they need to have done, because I want to. And the thing is that there are parts to that. Like Steve was saying, again, I think that as a backup position, it's better for me to do these things, even if I don't want to. And that has served me very, very well through the years in Alcoholics Anonymous, is to try and show up and do the things that I said I was going to do or that I need to do. But getting working on that part with the because I want to is a huge part, you know, of finding the joy of living. And, you know, in the beginning, in the foreword to the 12 and 12, the book, The 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions, you know, one of my favorite lines in our literature is where it says that these steps, these principles that we learn about in the steps and the traditions, actually, but that these principles are designed to help the sufferer be relieved of the compulsion to drink and to live happily and usefully whole. And that, I believe, is really, you know, the goal of what we're, you know, trying to do. And I love that happily is in there. And I didn't see happily in there for a long time. And I didn't experience happily either in my early years of sobriety because I was way too self-centered. And like Steve mentioned in a number of the, you know, different times when he was sharing, getting the relief of the bondage of self is a huge part of allowing me to be of service, to find some joy, and also to, you know, to really experience life on life's terms in a, you know, in that kind of a way. One of the things that I have written in my big book, and I actually didn't write, I don't write very many things in my big book. You know, when I grew up, I never had a hardbound book in my life until after I got sober. And so I still have this thing about writing in books. I do write, you know, an underline now in my big book in my 12 and 12, but it was really hard for me. And so after I'd been sober for a while, though, one of my my buddies that I got sober with, a guy named Howard P., he said this thing that I wrote in the front of my big book, and it says, success may be having everything that you want, but happiness is wanting what you have. And then Howard would go on and he would talk about, try to enjoy what you're getting because you're going to be getting it anyway. And so trying to get to that point where I can walk through, whatever life is dealing out. Years ago, you know, I heard one of the long timers say that our spiritual comfort or our ability, and I would equate this to emotional sobriety, to live with life's unresolved problems and be comfortable is really what these principles are going to allow us to do. In other words, to be okay when things are not okay. And I think it would be a better story. And I actually think it's true maybe for some people that there are things going on in their life and they're okay and they don't even think that those things bother them. But I'm not that person. You know, when I have, you know, family members that are suffering with extreme medical issues, I feel sad about that. And it's hard to show up and to do the right thing. But I have learned to do that. And I have been able to learn how to be okay as I walk through those things. And today, you know, I have so many friends that are, you know, dealing with some health issues, nothing to do with the virus, just the regular health issues that are going on, but they're involving surgeries. And some of those surgeries are scary. And so I'm not a person that believes that just because we are sober or even if we do have a strong conscious contact, that means that there won't be any fear. I don't think that any of our human emotions ever go away completely. But I have seen through the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and through the fellowship, I have seen people walk through every experience I can possibly imagine in the years that I have been sober. And I've seen people doing the same thing in Al-Anon that those that I have been close with. You know, I know that these principles work, as, you know, Bill Wilson talks about in his story, you know, that this is a design for living. And it's going to help us get through the certain rough spots ahead. And that doesn't mean that everything is about getting through rough spots. But I think that those are important factors that we know that we can get through these things. And that we can do it with dignity and a sense of humor and with an ability to pass it on, you know, to others. I'm going to go ahead and tell you one more thing, you know, and then I think we're going to get close to wrapping it up for our little break and then maybe come back for some questions or however we'll do that. But, you know, when I got to the program, I mentioned that I was filled with self-hatred. I very rarely could could listen to an entire meeting or certainly an entire speaker. I could listen to a couple minutes and then I'd have to get back to thinking about me. And years later, and it was all bad things about me. I'm so stupid. I'm so ugly. All these things I've done, I'm never going to be able to, you know, have a good life. Me, you know, whatever. But it was all about me. And years later, I was in a meeting and this guy shared and he said, you know, an egomaniac is not necessarily someone who thinks well of themselves. And I thought, really? Because I thought exactly that an egomaniac was someone who just thinks they're the best looking and they're the smartest and they're the most wonderful. And the guy said, it's not necessarily someone who thinks well of themselves. In fact, it's not necessarily someone who thinks often of themselves. It's simply someone who thinks only of themselves. And I realized many years sober that I was, in fact, a huge egomaniac. It was just that I was doing it in a negative way, constantly thinking about myself. And so I do believe, you know, one of the great gifts that we get in Alcoholics Anonymous is that relief from the bondage of self, of always thinking about what do I need? What do I want? I, me, which, you know, Chuck would talk about. And the way that that transformation has come about for me has been through service in large part in Alcoholics Anonymous, for looking, what can I add? What can I do to bring some light into a situation rather than take? That doesn't mean that I'm not a taker, because I am, and it switches, you know, costumes. You know, Sandy Veach used to talk about our character defects, you know, kind of change costumes so that they trick us too, so that I don't know that I've got that same character defect, you know, acting up again. And so we do have to continue to be vigilant and stay close to, you know, looking at what's going on in that part of the self-examination. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and stop for a minute, and I think I'll turn it back to Steve, and then he'll tell us what we're doing next. How's that?
Thanks, June. Never have I been given more latitude to tell people what we're doing and offer direction. I'm coming back here every week. This is tremendous. But, you know, June was just talking about those defects of character and Sandy talking about them coming in disguise or dressing differently. I often think of my defects of character as like kind of a little gang. Right. And what they do is they hold me hostage. You know, I'm in the bondage. When that third step prayer says that relieve me of the bondage of self, for a long time, I viewed it as self being held hostage. But in fact, self is the hostage taker. That ego is the hostage taker. But that ego is like a posse, you know, and the posse is made up of, you know, lust and greed and pride and sloth. And they'll just go like, say, hey, lust and jealousy, you guys watch him for a few minutes. We're taking a lunch break. You know, you've got this shift. And then they'll come back and go, okay, sloth, you're on the job. You guys won't really be doing anything for a little while, but just hang here. And then I don't realize how these defects of character are running my life. And it's because, and it talks about it in the readings around emotional sobriety and being spiritually awakened. And I'm going through life spiritually asleep. I am unconscious. And so often that these things, these driving forces in my life are subconscious or unconscious. I'm not aware of them. I don't see what's happening. I can't attribute it specifically to these things, which is why I'm led to do inventory and have this self-examination as I go through, which folks like me, like June, who just talked about, folks like us who think only of ourselves, it seems counter a little ironic that we would be in a program that requires daily self-examination. So I've got to be careful to make that constructive, quick, spot, admit, correct self-examination rather than turn into self-contemplation for days on end. But I want to take a look at me. That's kind of what I'm doing, is let me get a good look and see how I'm doing. You know, I often tell the people around here, you guys, most of you don't know me well. I do have some friends on here. But in truth, at 31 years sober, I'm AA is not trotting me out as the poster child for AA, but the people who knew me 32 years ago are really impressed with how well I'm doing. It doesn't look that great to you guys, but the 1988 group I ran with is unbelievably impressed with the growth that I've had. And so I wish I had the before picture, not just the photograph, but the behavior. I'm glad that there's not I wasn't captured on video back then like I would be today. But anyway, we'll take a 10-minute break and come back at either 2 o'clock or 4 o'clock, depending on where you're at. But I encourage you guys in the meantime, if there's a question or something you want to hear about that we hadn't touched on yet, feel free to put it in the chat and we'll kind of look at those when we get back and see if there's anything to talk about there. So Yvonne, back to you and we'll crank back up at 2 or 4, depending on where you're at.
Thank you, Steve. Well, I'm at the 2 o'clock here. I'm in Pacific Standard Time, Bay Area, San Francisco. We have clear air and blue skies for a change after inhaling all this smog and smoke and soot. Welcome, if you're new to Al-Anon Without Borders. This is our workshop series. We've got a series coming up on emotional sobriety and on Al-Anon workshops. We also are working on a Native American conference on October 17, 18. If you have any questions, you can put it in the chat. You can put it publicly. You can put it privately to June or either Steve. Feel free. Go to the bathroom. Get something to eat. You don't have to mind me right now if you don't want to. What I did look up was, if it's okay with June and Steve, and I'm sure it is, as they have 4 hours to open up the next session with the reading on the essay of Bill W. on emotional sobriety, which I normally start this off with, but, you know, not always there either. Because I always find that very fascinating, the next frontier. And I hope you guys have been enjoying it so far. I know I have. I'm just looking at who's on camera and who's not. Debbie, I haven't seen you in a while from Prosper, Texas. Hey. Good to see you. And if anybody would like to share something, you can always stick your hand in the air and I will quickly tap you. We only have 10 minutes, but sure we can. Which means I have to look at the hands, if there is any. Amanda, you're on here from Australia. See, this is what you get when you go to a different screen. Now I'm looking at the participants. Good to see you, Amanda, although it's only your picture. And what do I want to say? Lots of things I want to say. I'm just shopping around on who's on and who's not. I saw Brian from Ferndale, are you still here? You must have turned off your camera because I can't see you. Anyway, good seeing you. I know that Brian is in Washington. He's got some great workshops or great speaker meetings going on Monday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard. I was going to put him on, but he ain't here. So that's not happening. Let me see here. Wow, you guys are quiet a lot. Okay. Your first AA Zoom meeting from Puerto Rico, Viviana. Well, welcome, Viviana. Thank you for introducing yourself. Good to see you. It is, you must be, what, 3 hours ahead of us, Pacific Standard Time? Here, let me unmute you. There. Can you unmute yourself?
Done.
Yeah. Hi, Viviana.
Can I unmute myself?
Yes, you did.
Okay. Hi, everyone. It's good to be with all of you. It's my first AA meeting on Zoom. Actually, my sister sent me a text, and she said she was in the meeting, and I said, let me try it. So very good to listen to all of you. very grateful. Thank you.
I can hear you. I can see you. Awesome. How could you have not been on Zoom? Good for you.
Yes.
You so love Puerto Rico. Want to go there one of these days? Somebody heard Steve's tape from Myrtle Beach. I'm very happy to hear you and see you in person virtually today. Yes, you do got a great sense of humor. You know, I love what Steve was saying about most people were not impressed with me, but if they could see me now and they've known me then. And, you know, for a lot of years, my sponsor would say, Yvonne, stop comparing your insides to other people's outsides. And I would just look at him like, yeah, whatever. And then he says, you know, why don't you compare yourself to yourself? You'll always win. And I thought, well, what does that mean? I mean, really, what does that mean? And today I'm like, oh, yeah, that means that if I look back, I've come a long way. I may not be where I want to be or may not be where I think I should be or other people think that I should be. But boy, if you would have known me 20 years ago, yeah, take cover. You think I'm bad now, just multiply that by 100. And so, you know, today I can actually say, I know what that means. If I compare myself to myself, I'll always win. If I compare myself to you, I will probably always lose. Just for something that's in the chat privately, I would love to announce, but once I start announcing and once we do that, there is so many things going on. I don't really want this being trafficked just because people want to put their stuff out there. That has happened in the past, and it just turns into chaos on the chat. So I make it a habit not to announce any events that that are locally going on. If it's a worldwide event, I may do it. I've announced the sponsorship events that were going on for a while in Arizona for a year, but I just don't want to make exceptions because then there is always somebody angry at me. I've learned that. I've learned not to pay favorites. So thank you for asking me anyway. I appreciate your respect for asking me and not just putting it out there. I just want to keep this on the focus of whatever we're doing, whether it's AA or Al-Anon or just program. Thank you for that. Everything is being recorded in American Sign Language as well as audio only. And you can listen to those at MSB Recording, Amat Audio, and Recovery Tapers. The websites maneuver differently. Just find out which one maneuver best for you. Thank you, Liz W., for sharing. So that's some of the things that we do. If you're a certified interpreter and you would like to contribute to our American Sign Language interpretation, contact us at awbroundup@gmail.com. We'd love to have you if you're a certified interpreter and donate some of your time. We also have CDs that we can send to you, and you can record from the comfort of your home and translate them into American Sign Language. The only thing we ask is that you're skilled in 12-step language. Apparently that is, well, it's in our language, it's a different language too, so I'm starting to babble. Let's see. Sarah from Martinez, Georgia. Hi. You're so serious today. I can see you. Who are you, Sarah? Oh, sorry. That was me.
I'm trying to unmute.
I know.
Yeah, I'm just kind of lazy, but I've been trying to do some stuff. And for some reason, I didn't get the email about this, but I remembered you saying that it would be happening like a month or two ago.
If you're looking for flyers, you can always go to the tapers that you can listen to the recordings. They have a website.
Yeah. So I will. But how do I find out if I'm still on the email list? Don't you send the flyer out still?
Yeah, we still do a mass email. Send me a little email on AWB and I will forward it to Billy and he may want to look and check if you're still on there. But we still do it that way, yeah.
Yvonne?
Yes.
I have only done the one email, the one mailing with the flyer for the all of them. So if that seems to be a problem, I will go ahead and send one out this coming week, since we've got another one next weekend.
Yeah, all these are on one flyer, all the workshops.
I'd appreciate it.
I'll send them out. And go ahead and send us, make sure.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Billy. I appreciate your service.
Yeah, so for those who are not familiar, on the websites that you listen to the recordings, there's oodles of flyers, AA, Al-Anon, all sorts of flyers.
So what is the email again?
A-W-
Can you put it in the chat?
Yeah, we will put it in the chat.
Bless you.
Great.
Thank you. It's good to see you. I appreciate your service.
It's good to see you, too. Let me make my screen a little bit bigger here so I can actually read this. All right.